25-7003, United States versus Phillips. Counsel for appellant, if you would make your appearance and proceed, please.
May it please the court, I'm Neil Van Dalsum. I'm here for the defendant appellant, Thomas Raymond Phillips. Under the law of this circuit, in a murder case, when the issue of imperfect self-defense is raised and supported by the evidence, it is plain error for the court to fail to instruct the jury of the government's burden to disprove imperfect self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. That was the court's holding in Merry Boy. And that is what happened at trial in this case.
Even though the government in a footnote seemed somewhat questioning about the whether there was invited error, why isn't there invited error here? I mean, you had a situation where didn't the defense counsel ask for an instruction and have an opportunity to review the instruction, and that the district court gave the instruction that the defendant wanted?
No. What I believe there you're referring to a discussion of the diminished capacity instruction.
No, I don't think so. But you can talk about that one if you want. I think that in both instances, was it not a situation where the defense asked for those instructions?
What happened is the defendant did not submit an instruction pre-trial that requested a not imperfect self-defense element. Then at trial, the district court produced an instruction that was intended to instruct the jury on the ideas of self-defense and imperfect self-defense. The government objected to any instructions about self-defense or imperfect self-defense. Defense counsel argued in favor of giving an instruction, and then there was no objection made to the instructions as actually given. But what we really have is the district court sua sponte deciding to instruct on imperfect self-defense, and then a lack of an objection to the instruction as given. And under the law of this circuit, just failing to object to an instruction is reviewed for plain error.
But it's not just failing to object. The defense counsel, when the court presented the instructions, the defense counsel advocated for it. Right. I mean, the prosecutor said we don't need them, and you advocated for it. So it's not that you it's not a situation where you just didn't object to the presentation of the instruction. You said, I want that instruction. Right.
We want an instruction on the issues of in reality, if you go to the argument that was made, which is quoted at page 22 of my opening brief. The argument is, look, Judge, this could be involuntary manslaughter. And the involuntary manslaughter would be based upon a finding of imperfect self-defense. And that is what the debate was about, was is imperfect self-defense, is self-defense at issue in this case? And defense counsel said, yes, those are at issue. This could be an involuntary manslaughter case, and the court proceeded with the instruction as given, as the court drafted. But there was not a, yes, that is a perfect explanation of the law. The other thing is the error in the instruction is really in the first degree murder and second degree murder involuntary manslaughter instructions. That's where the problem arises, that is the plain error. It is the failure to add as an element to those offenses that it's not imperfect self-defense.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but okay, let's go with that for a second. Okay, the error as you identify it, relates to the who has the burden of proof on imperfect self-defense, right?
Correct.
Okay. And let's assume for the moment we are under plain error rubric, and we'll put aside the question of invited error, okay? Because I understood you to start your argument on that basis. Let's go with that for a second. If we are under plain error, what would stop prong? How did you satisfy your burden as to prong three? I mean, it seems to me that in this situation, there was no suggestion that he was threatened at all, that Mr. Phillips was threatened. Who threatened him? And how would the Bert, and so why would he have been prejudiced by the instruction as it relates to plain error and effect on substantial rights? Clarify that for me, please.
The district court, exercising its discretion, having reviewed all of the evidence, determined that imperfect self-defense was a question for this jury to resolve. That determination was supported by quite a bit of evidence. The defendant had just been beaten up. He just sustained three blows to the head that were pretty serious. So serious that a witness testified that any one of those blows could have killed a person. He is then leaves the bar. He's disoriented. He doesn't know his own wife, according to her. He
Well,
strikes his.
that's a little bit of a liberal interpretation,
Well, she
she never
actually
says that.
she actually
She says that he
testifies, I
acted
don't think.
disoriented, but I understand
She actually testifies that he did. I don't think he knew who I was, is
your
part of
point.
her
Okay, I
testimony.
overlooked that then. Okay.
He doesn't know where he is. He doesn't know what's going on. He had post-traumatic stress disorder before this event even happened that was diagnosed by the VA. After he's reviewed, it's confirmed, yes, he does have PTSD. There was expert testimony that his behavior was consistent with having a traumatic brain injury. There was expert testimony that a person with PTSD and suffering from a traumatic brain injury, which he appeared to be, would experience an inability to assess dangers, to properly respond to dangers, and could be in a dissociative state, meaning that you are not in connection with reality. The shots were not fired immediately upon him reaching his truck. The shots were fired when one of the people who had been involved in smacking his head real hard three times exited the door of the bar. That's when the shooting began. Taking all of this together, there is a factual basis, and the district court correctly found there was a factual basis for a jury to develop reasonable doubt. And that's a key point, too. For purposes of this error, the question is not whether Mr. Phillips proved that he acted in imperfect self-defense. It's whether a juror could have a reasonable doubt about that fact. And
Mr. Dawson, can I'm sorry to interrupt you, so I hope you
sure.
remember your train of thought, but I have a couple of questions. But the first the precedent, the antecedent question is, can we take into account that the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed premeditated murder? I know you have an argument that you alluded to a moment ago that, well, the court that there may that may have been attributable to a defect in the instructions because maybe the imperfect self-defense was not included among the elements that the government had to disprove. But I'm just asking you, can we take into account that the judge found premed or I mean the jury found premeditated murder?
I don't think you should on the record presented in this case.
Well, that's a
This
different question. That's my second question. So I'm just asking you if legally, if there's some legal impediment to considering it.
what I would say, Judge, is in two cases, Sago and Walker, this court has commented on the idea that, well, in this case, the jury found premeditation.
Well, and
In
also
both of
Yeah, and also in Rainford. So, and in Mary Boy. So, but that's really a good prelude to my question. So Judge Hartz, and although he did include, saying for in the facts of this case, how likely is it on the facts of this case that the jury would conclude that he premeditated the murder, but then in fact decided to kill out of fear? There's a sentence in Mary Boy itself where Judge Phillips specifically says that if the jury found that Mary Boy had intentionally shot Monawine, the decedent, the instructional error would not have affected his substantial rights. And then in the Rainford case that you cited, we actually included language interpreting Sago to mean that a conviction for first-degree murder could reduce the likelihood that a jury could have found involuntary manslaughter based on self-defense. So it seems to me that this trilogy of cases that we've recently stated, it doesn't say it forecloses the finding that a jury might have found imperfect self-defense, but basically it elucidates Judge Hartz's skepticism that if the jury finds that I decided in advance to go and kill Joe Schmo, then how likely is it that if the jury had said, well, I have the government had a burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that I had not acted in imperfect self-defense, how likely is it that I acted defensively, irrationally, if the jury also found that I had premeditated the murder? And that seems to be at least a fairly logical reason to at least express skepticism, particularly in prong three of plain error. So in any event, that's my long-winded question for you.
In both Sago and Walker, if you look at the facts of the case, there is simply no evidence to support the idea of self-defense at all. In Sago, a guy goes over to somebody's house and he's trying to get him to come out. And then, with no violence, no anything, no threats, no nothing, he shoots the person when he comes out of his house.
Is it, but
In
he thinks
Walker,
that he's coming, but he thinks he's mad, right?
he
He thinks he's mad,
there's no evidence to suggest that he had any reason to think he was mad
and
when he
it,
went
well,
to
you could
his
make an
house.
argument that Tommy didn't have a reason to think that when he opened the door that he was, that he was going out to, to renew this killing, but I don't know that the quibbling on about the facts, and you have really good argument. I'm not trying to be argumentative with you, but it just seems to me that if the fella, if my memory in Sago is right, is that he's just sitting there. The guy is coming to him. The decedent is coming to him. He's not armed. His wife had testified that he's got a smile on his face. He's happy to see this young kid. And the guy irrationally thinks he's bad, that he's, shouldn't have been coming to his house. And then he kills him. And then Judge Hart says, well, how likely is it that if the jury found that the guy had come over to the house with a premeditated design to murder the guy, how likely is it that the jury would have come to a different conclusion? And that seems to be a pretty good, paraphrase of the facts of this case. But anyway,
I
that's
would
what I'm
point
trying to
out,
ask you about.
in both Britt and Rainford, neither one of those were plain error review, but in both of those cases, this court reversed first-degree murder convictions because of errors in the instructions on imperfect self-defense.
Okay.
So the fact that the conviction is first-degree murder is certainly not dispositive, and what should be dispositive more so are two things. One, the underlying facts. This case is different than Sago and Walker in that this is a person who has PTSD, who just got hit in the head three times very hard, and appears to be very disoriented about what's going on, and reported after the fact that he believed he was tackled in the parking lot. So he thought that there is evidence that he thought that he had been assaulted in the parking lot also. Additionally, I would, there's a case that's been cited by both parties, United States versus Duran. If the court finds that there is a basis to give the instruction and it's not given, a plainly erroneous jury instruction affects a defendant's substantial rights if the instruction concerns a principal element of the defense or an element of the crime, thus suggesting that the error affected the outcome of the case. And I would submit that's what we have here. If the instruction left out malice aforethought, everybody would say, yep, that seems like a big problem. Leaving out something that negates malice aforethought is also a big problem and affects a substantial right. If the instruction was warranted, as the district court basically found, then it affects a substantial right to not instruct on the burden of proof and mislead the jury about who has the burden and not really even tell them what that burden is. And I'm out of time.
Anything more for defense counsel? All right, thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government now.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Jared Lehman for the United States. I think the facts of this case are really what's driving the answer of plain error. And it's extraordinarily important to understand that the defendant was not in some sort of dazed or confused or disoriented state. This was not the type of bar fight where the other patrons beat or punched or struck or kicked the defendant. This was their attempt to get him out of the bar. Were they rough with him? Absolutely. Did they take him to the ground? Absolutely. But no one was kicking him. No one was beating him or anything like that. They
Are you
stood him up.
saying, you're saying from the video that a jury couldn't find that when these three rather large fellas grab, and I'm not saying he wasn't provocative or shouldn't have been acting the way he did. I don't think Mr. Van Dalsum is arguing that. But are you saying when they, those three big guys, took his head and slammed it against the bar? And then when you call it talking, taking to the ground, I call it throwing him to the ground. His head hits the concrete. The evidence is, as Mr. Van Dalsum said, that the testimony was that this could have very well have caused a traumatic brain injury. Are you saying that he wasn't entitled to the instruction on proof beyond a reasonable doubt because these guys were, just being gentle with him?
Correct. We have to take it a
That's
step
not in the
further, Your
same
Honor.
video that I watched.
Your Honor, we have to take it a step further, and we have to couple it with what they did after that. They stood him up. They gave him his things. They told him they were calling the police. They sent him out of the bar. The fight was done. Everything was over. It was clear the patron's intent was to kick him out of the bar. And so again, sure, the video displays what it displays. But we also have to take into context what they did. Stood him up, gave him his things, sent him outside. He was absolutely free to go. He had his possessions, he had his car keys. His spouse came out there with him a short time later. He was 100% free to go. And in fact, the patrons had told him, "We've called the police. The police are on their way." So there's
How does all any
nothing.
of that all that is great for a defense of perfect self-defense. How does any of that have any relevance to an imperfect self-defense? Let's say hypothetically that he was high on methamphetamine. Are you saying, well, we told him that he could go. I mean, he was drugged out of his mind, and he thought, he was elucidated that the guy that when he came out of the door, that he was actually afraid that he was going to come back at him. After all, he had just been beaten up. By this guy, along with two of his accomplices. And so, how does the fact that he was free to go have anything to do with whether or not he was entitled to a proof beyond a reasonable doubt instruction on a defense that the judge acknowledged that the jury could have found in perfect self-defense? And this is not perfect self-defense. It's imperfect self-defense. He's got traumatic brain. He could have had traumatic brain injury. He had been diagnosed with PTSD, and it certainly could have been at least according to the district judge, a basis for an imperfect self-defense. I don't understand why how your argument really pertains to the legal issue that we have to confront.
Your Honor, I think it gets to the core of what was in the defendant's mind. There's no evidence in the record that I can find where the defendant subjectively believed that he had to use lethal force to repel an imminent serious bodily injury or death upon his person or another individual. There's nothing in there for the trial judge to have hung his hat on to support that jury instruction.
Do you have to have that? They didn't
Yes,
have
Your
that.
Honor. That,
They, in Toledo, for example, the court said that, as you point out, that the defendant did testify that he was under the subjective apprehension of bodily harm, but the court also said, but there was other evidence involving his psychological defects, and those would have contributed to maybe a subjective apprehension of bodily injury. How do you
sure.
distinguish Toledo?
Your Honor, I think the defendant tells us that he's no longer in a defensive state of mind. So remember, when the fight's over and they stand him up and they're walking him out of the door, he goes on the offensive. It's gone from a defensive situation to an offensive situation, and his state of mind reflects that. He uses a anti-gay slur and says that he's going to kill the bar patrons. He goes outside. He's combative with his wife. And this whole concept that he doesn't recognize his wife is substantially hard to credit. She comes out and she stumbles and he swears to her and calls her a very bad thing. I won't quote it here. It's in the brief. But he's clearly being combative and insulting towards his wife. And then he pistol whips his wife. Clearly, again, the defendant is on the offensive. This isn't some defensive state of mind. He doesn't tell his wife, look out, they're coming to get us. He doesn't tell his wife, hey, we need to get in the car and go. He doesn't tell his wife, run. He doesn't tell his wife, call the cops. I'll stand here and make sure they don't come and get us. He's very abrasive and offensive towards his wife. She goes back.
Counsel, can I interrupt, because I want to kind of back you up, and I think we're all familiar with these facts, and you're arguing facts, and I don't understand why we're talking about facts at the error stage, whether there was plain error. What is this? Are we talking about substantial rights now? Because you have to concede there was error here based on Mary Boy. I mean, at the point of error or plain error, we don't look at whether or not this instruction should not have been given. We are assuming the district court gave the instruction, there was a reason for it, and now our case law is clear. It was error. It was error not to, and it was plain error. It's clear that it's plain error. It was error not to explain that it was the government's burden to disprove this point. But I guess where I'm going with this is, I think you're talking about this might have some relevance to substantial rights, but I don't see any case where we've looked at this as substantial rights on the third prong. And you cite some case from the Second Circuit. I don't even know if that was a plain error case, but if it was, that was a completely different case that they looked at. They looked at this issue, and the defendant actually committed an armed robbery, and essentially they found he invited the error. But I don't see any authority that says once we find that there was plain error on this instruction, that we don't just reverse in terms of how this might have impacted the jury. We don't go back and say, well, let's take a look at these facts again and let's judge for ourselves whether this should have ever been given in the first place. Is that something we do at prong three?
Your Honor, I think Sago indicates that that's the case. That was very important in the Sago case, is that it wouldn't have made a difference in that particular set of facts. Additionally, the court's recent decision.
Was that a substantial, was that at prong three in Sago?
Your Honor, I believe that's how they analyzed that case,
okay.
Your Honor. I believe that's correct.
Okay.
It was under prong three of plain error. Additionally, the court's recent case in Brown, I believe it's a March of 2025 case. In that case, as I recall, one of the things that they analyzed, maybe even under prong four, prong three and four of plain error, was there wasn't an overwhelming amount of evidence regarding the premeditation, regarding the facts of the case. Well, here we have the opposite. I would submit to this court that we do have an overwhelming amount of evidence. The defendant committed a premeditated murder and had no subjective belief that he was under some sort of immediate or imminent threat of serious bodily injury to himself or another. So that's
what I'm struggling with is, I think what Judge Moritz is struggling with, it sounds like you're arguing that there was no error in the instruction. I mean, that's not where we are, is it? I mean, we are accepting that the court should have given the instruction, that the court erred in not putting the burden where it should be. And the question is what the consequence of that is. Isn't that where we are?
I'll agree with half of that, Your Honor. I agree the instruction is wrong. I agree the instruction as given is an error. I can't agree, Your Honor, that the defendant was entitled to it in the first place. And so what I'm trying to argue, Your Honor, is even if the court hadn't given it, then we wouldn't be error. So therefore, if the defendant got it, the error inured in a way to his benefit, because he got to argue for something that, frankly, the United States does not believe he was entitled to argue. He did not present enough evidence, although the standard is remarkably low, did not present enough evidence to show that he actually possessed the belief that he was in imminent fear of death or serious bodily injury. There's not enough evidence there to even warrant the instruction. And so that's my proposition, that there's not an error, because he wasn't even entitled to the instruction. To the extent that he was, then we really get into prong three, where it wouldn't have made a difference because the defendant's guilt in this case was substantially overwhelming. He said two different times, "I'm going to kill you." He walked 50 feet to his car, got his gun, loaded it, according to the testimony, didn't get his gun straight out and fire, and most importantly, didn't shoot at the door where the patron came out and asked him what he was doing, but shot nine times in a spread pattern across the width of the bar. There is no doubt at all that it just would not have made any difference. There's no jury instruction in the world on self-defense that would have made a single bit of difference in this case.
Is it a problem that imperfect self-defense was not included among the elements that the government didn't need to disprove? So in other words, if we disagree with you and think that viewing the evidence of life most favorable to the defendant, that he would have been entitled to an instruction, the very instruction that the district court did give, but not in the context of one of the elements that the government had to disprove in order to find one of the elements in order to find to convict the defendant of first degree murder. Is that a problem? If we think that the jury could have found imperfect self-defense, even if the evidence was overwhelming?
If it would have made a difference, I think is the question that the court has to answer. And if it would have made a difference, then the jury was improperly instructed. And that has historically in the circuit survived plain error review, starting with, I don't think Britt was plain error, but in the cases after Britt in the plain error context, when that instruction is given poorly or doesn't identify the government's burden, then that has constituted plain error.
But you understand that is not my question. There's two separate arguments that I think Mr. Van Delsom has made. Most of the attention has been focused in his briefing and today on his argument that the government wasn't put to its burden of disproving imperfect self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. But one of the problems that he's identified is when the judge gave the elements for first degree murder, he did not include the need to disprove at all imperfect self-defense. So theoretically, the jury could have gone into the deliberation room and said, well, let's look through the elements of first degree murder. And I don't see anything about it. Imperfect self-defense. Yeah, he had a design to kill the person. Never considered whether or not he had a design because he was afraid that he was going to be killed or beaten up. And so is that a problem?
In light of Sago and in light of the jury finding premeditation, Your Honor, I don't think that it is under a plain error standard review.
But how could Sago help you? I mean, I understand Sago is a good case on the second argument that Mr. Van Delsom has made, but I don't understand the whole premise of Judge Hartz's analysis in Sago is that the jury had found imperfect self-defense and somehow had factored into the consideration of the circumstances. But if the jury finds, let's say that I intend to go out and kill somebody, I think that the person is setting out to kill me, and I and the judge and the judge tells the jury only, well, to find Bacharach convicted of guilty of first degree murder, you have to find that he had a design to kill the person, that he intended to kill, malice aforethought, that he struck the fatal blow. Well, I'm guilty of all that. I don't know that that would implicate Judge Hartz's analysis. I do think Judge Hartz's analysis would apply to the second element, and that is if the government had the burden to prove, to disprove it beyond a reasonable doubt, whether that would affect the analysis of imperfect self-defense. But the problem that he's identifying, Mr. Van Dalsen, in one of his in his first argument is the jury never had to consider imperfect self-defense at all in order to convict this guy of first degree murder.
Your Honor, I don't think that it would have made a difference. And so again, back to the government's original argument, we don't have error because the defendant was never entitled to the instruction. That's the United States' position in this case. Your Honor, I'm very, very close to out of time. Happy to answer any additional questions.
I don't think we have any. And I think your time, Mr. Van Dalsen, is out. And so case is submitted. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments.